The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. A couple of quick announcements. The first one is that we're using the 60-minute format for tonight's program. So if you want to get an email in or a call in to our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, please be aware that the show is 60 minutes and not the typical 90 minutes. So don't wait until the last minute because you'll likely miss your opportunity. So, again, we're on the 60-minute program tonight. So a couple of quick announcements for the shortened program. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring and be patient, and I'll bring up your call as soon as possible and get you on the air. And then our website, thespaceshow.com, so do check it out. Our full and detailed website newsletter is there, plus if you scroll down a little further, our entire schedule through the balance of the year is there. We are filling programs right now for November and December. Remember, everything we do is archived. You can quickly download shows or listen right off of our site. Don't forget we have a store. It's up in the upper left menu under support, and you can get Space Show t-shirts and coffee mugs and things of that nature. And in addition, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, which means that we need your support to keep the Space Show going. And there are a couple of ways to support us. One is you'll see the PayPal link on our homepage. So obviously contributing through PayPal, or if you prefer sending us a check, please use One Giant Leap Foundation Incorporated as the name on the check. And we appreciate your support. If you are a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction. If you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction for your gift, as we're a California public benefit corporation. Amazon also has great programs to support nonprofits. They have two of them. If you click on the big Amazon link on our homepage, again, you can't possibly miss it. We explain the two ways that you can purchase whatever it is you want at Amazon, and Amazon gives a small percentage to the Space Show on every purchase. So it's a great way to support the Space Show, doing what you always do, which is buying from Amazon, supporting Jeff Bezos, I guess, and in a way, supporting Blue Origin. So we thank you for support. Your support does absolutely keep us on the air. Remember, we're trademarked and copyrighted, and you are free to download our shows and share them. Please don't share them. Please don't edit the shows and then put them up on YouTube or some other website, including your own. So no edits or cuts are permitted. Nothing commercial with the programs is permitted. And we do not allow written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. So you can check out our full copyright statement on the bottom of our website and at the bottom of OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me. We do have sponsors. Check out the sponsors' ads going across our homepage with their banner ads. And I do want to take a moment to thank all our sponsors, because we're on the 60-minute format. I'm not going to read their messages, but we certainly thank the Integrated Space Analytics Company in Florida. They make the Integrated Space Plan. Orbital ATK is a sponsor. We're appreciative of their support. The AIAA is a sponsor, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And Celestis is a sponsor, and of course they're the global leader in Memorial Spaceflight Services. and we certainly appreciate their sponsorship. We have additional new sponsors coming online for 2017, and if you're interested in being a sponsor for the Space Show in the coming year, contact me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And that brings me to our program tonight. So I'm very happy to introduce for the first time both a subject on the Space Show, Space Object Behavioral Sciences, and Dr. Moriba Jha, and he is at the University of Arizona, and he is the director of the Space Objects Behavioral Sciences, which is, I guess, a new department. And he has experience with NASA Mars missions. He's worked for the Air Force in situational awareness. He has led programs and worked for the Air Force Research Lab. He's directed Air Force Advanced Sciences and Technology Research Institute for Astronautics. That was on Maui, Hawaii. He did that for many years doing that, and he was also at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. And if that was not enough, he is a spacecraft navigator. And that's a title he shares with very few people. And he did that at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab from 1999 to 2006, chartering courses for Mars Global Surveyor, Mars Odyssey, Mars Exploration Rovers, and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. His bio goes on and on and on. It is posted on the Space Show website. I urge you to read it in full. And do check out the University of Arizona website for the Space Object Behavioral Sciences. And it's really an easy website to remember. So it's SOBS, S-O-B-S, so you can imagine what that stands for. So that's the Space Orbital Behavioral Sciences, .arizona.edu. And you can find all of your information about our guest tonight, as well as the subject matter. Moriba, welcome to the Space Show, and it's very nice to have you on board. How are you tonight?
Doing very well, and thank you very much for such a great introduction. I'm very excited to be here. Very honored.
So this is a new subject for me and probably for most of the Space Show listeners. So introduce us to Space Object Behavioral Sciences. What are we talking about?
Right. So, foundationally, what Space Object Behavioral Sciences is all about is we seek to assess, predict, and really quantify the behavior of all objects in space, whether they be natural objects or man-made. And as you can imagine, for the man-made objects, some of these objects are orbital debris, things that are defunct or pieces of old satellites and rocket bodies. But the reason for the behavioral sciences piece to this name is that several people have come to me asking me to try to predict the intent of a satellite. And so they say, hey, Moriba, so could you tell me what the intent of that satellite is? And I say, yeah, sure. The answer is easy. It has none. Satellites don't have intent because they're not people. And so to really understand the behavior of all objects in space, especially man-made objects and ones that work, that are actively controlled, there is a need to understand people in the context of that behavior. And an interesting thing that goes along with that is if, for instance, if people wanted to understand how American culture is manifested in space object behavior, one quick example is that if you look at when most objects controlled by American people actually do propulsive maneuvers, you'll see that you're not going to find a whole lot of these maneuvers that happened on weekends, holidays, Fridays, or Mondays. Certainly weekends and holidays make sense, but you don't want to do a maneuver on Friday because you don't want that to be the thing that you try to do before you go home, and if something doesn't happen properly, then you got to stay in at work for some extra time. And you certainly don't want to do them on Mondays when you come fresh from home and a restful weekend. So, American culture is such that most maneuvers happen on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, and that sort of thing. But other countries don't necessarily subscribe to that. And so really, if you want to understand the behavior of these objects in space, there's a cultural and a societal aspect to this, and that's why we have the behavioral sciences aspect to that.
So I'm actually probably one of the few space people doing something like I'm doing whose background is liberal science, is behavioral sciences, instead of engineering or any of the hard sciences. So I was government political science and up to my ears in behavioral science and social studies and, you know, all of these related fields. So, you know, all of this was up to us, and I went to the University of Arizona, by the way, for my undergraduate work way back when. And that would really date me. And, you know, a lot of this was based on, you know, conscious behavior, unconscious behavior, maybe what was ethical or not ethical. And so obviously the hardware in space doesn't, you know, have any consciousness or anything like that. But you're saying we have programmed it to maneuver and do things based on our culture, on our ethics to whatever degree that may show up in space, you know, our morality, stuff like that. So we're transferring it into the space hardware, and then how we relate to that hardware and maneuver it and control it.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And so a lot of people don't really take that into account or don't give it a second thought, but in reality that's definitely an input into trying to understand and explain, you know, why things in space behave the way they do.
So we're almost 16 years old on the space show and coming up on 3,000 programs, and you're the first where this has ever even come up even in any way whatsoever. So if we look at the object behavior of the military, of a military object, say versus a commercial geosatellite or maybe some other, you know, kind of space object or satellite, does the military culture and what would that look like? How does that get programmed into how objects behave?
Right. So, I mean, I would say that it's all driven by customer needs. You know, for commercial operators, they want to, you know, maximize profit. They have investors, stakeholders. They have a service that they're providing, and they want to deliver that service as optimally as possible, and they want to maximize profit, whereas defense people have different needs driven by national security. And so that's the top function that they're trying to maximize, is the ability to deliver on those national security needs. And so that undoubtedly manifests itself into how these things behave, how they behave in space.
Does how the military relate with each other, for example, you know, the command structure, giving orders to people, things like that, does that kind of behavior toward one another show up in somehow in defense hardware in space? Because I would imagine commercial companies don't have quite the same command structure. I mean, I do know they have, you know, employment hierarchy and, you know, leaders in the business and stuff like that, but it really isn't the same as being in the military. So does that kind of social structure show up somehow?
Well, to be honest, because this is still something new, and this whole field of space object behavioral science is something that I pretty much created in January of this year, so it's still in its infancy, I haven't gotten far along down the road to be able to assess whether or not you could actually disambiguate those sorts of things. But I have to say that, you know, having colleagues that do work for these commercial entities, you know, the decision-making process is actually, it's surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, very similar between, you know, defense organizations and civil and commercial entities. I mean, you know, it's users have specific needs. They're driven to satisfy those needs. And if anything shows up that might, you know, hamper or hinder or alter or degrade any of those services and capabilities, that's going to be something of concern. And so decisions will be made not only to provide the services optimally, but also to try to deter or avoid any loss, disruption, or degradation of those services and capabilities. So regardless of your organizational structure, those are the two things that are definitely going to be driving your behavior.
Are you far enough along to ascertain differences in space hardware coming from other countries like China or Russia, for example, or India? Are there big differences that show up in how they program and maneuver and work with their hardware?
Well, so for sure, in the way that these things maneuver, you can even see it in the news, in the sense that you do find some news articles that seem a little bit alarmed at how other countries are maneuvering their objects, maybe raising some as being suspect of nefarious acts or intent or that sort of stuff. But one of the things that motivated me to try to look into creating this whole field of space object behavioral sciences was, can we put the behavior in cultural context such that we are more realist and less alarmist with what's going on in space? And that's not to say that there aren't any threats in space. There's certainly reason to believe that that those are real, but at the same time, anything that is not necessarily explicable or easily explicable, I believe we probably shouldn't lean towards assuming that it's the worst case scenario first. And so what I'm trying to do is provide the science and a knowledge base that's sufficiently accurate and precise to be able to start disambiguating these things and put behavior into a more appropriate context, so that if there is a reason to be concerned, that there's high level of confidence that that concern is a real concern versus something just based out of panic, if you see what I mean.
You already have a question from Carl, who is in Philadelphia, and he says, is there any kind of database that you can tap into? For example, there must be tons of information on behavioral characteristics of Americans from all over America, people from Russia, Europe, China, India, the countries that you mentioned. So I would imagine there are behavioral databases with at least general characteristics. Can you tap into that for what you're trying to do with space hardware?
Right. So one of the things that we're looking at bringing on board the team are people that actually do understand, that are well-versed in these specific cultures of, people across our planet, and trying to bring in, that culture's societal beliefs, the culture's doctrine, and even historically, how have these cultures behaved over time, and try to then, given that understanding, seek correlations with known objects in the space around Earth that belong to those countries, to see if there is correlation and to what extent that correlation exists to help explain that behavior. So that's where we are right now, is bringing those sorts of people in, but we have not gotten far enough to start trying to seek correlations between those known kind of humanistic behaviors within these cultures and correlating those to observed activities in space.
How is this concept or this field of study being received? I know you spoke at AIAA. How is it being received by others in the industry? Is there interest, or other schools planning to, get on the bandwagon and start a similar department?
Yeah, so I think there's actually a wide interest in space object behavioral sciences, because there are a variety of, possible stakeholders. On one hand, you have defense organizations that, like I said, they're concerned about their own national security needs and being able to make sure that they can meet those needs and provide critical space services and capabilities without loss, degradation, or disruption. And so they're interested in being able to predict that behavior to support their own decision making capabilities. But then you have civil government entities like, say, NOAA, who are interested in optimizing the ability to deliver services related to weather products, things that are critical in giving us warning when we have climate that could pose harm or threaten our way of life, like hurricanes and whatnot. But then you have commercial entities, like I said, that are driven by profit and wanting to make sure that they can optimally deliver those specific goods that exploit space to their user base, again, without loss, disruption, or degradation. So there's a wide variety of stakeholders, all with interests that may be germane to them, but the link connecting these interests is the ability to quantify, assess, and predict the behavior of these objects relevant to their needs. So yes, it's well received. There are actual other universities, not just in the United States, but worldwide, that are that have an interest in collaborating and becoming a part of this, for sure.
Sally is in Portland, Oregon, and she says that we constantly hear about the orbital debris problems, especially in LEO, but LEO is not the only place where it's a problem. Is there an application for what you're doing in trying to understand space debris and maybe coming up with a cleanup or mitigation strategy?
Yeah, so I appreciate Sally's question. The answer is yes, absolutely. In fact, one of my colleagues is Dr. J.C. Liu, who is the chief scientist for NASA's Orbital Debris Program Office at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. And, you know, J.C. and I have known each other for years, and he's quite aware of the work that we are doing. You know, one of the cool things, and thanks again to Sally's question, one of the cool things that we're trying to do is we're approaching this population of man-made objects in a very different way than other people have done. And one of the interesting things is that so far, when people do space surveillance and they try to understand what's in space, they typically worry about one object at a time. Each object is an individual, and one of the main assumptions is that the behavior, the state, the motion of any given object is uncorrelated to anything else. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me for a variety of reasons, which I'll get into here a little bit further. But the cool thing that we're doing is we're taking a page out of biological systems. It's like, you know, any of us can relate to turning on the TV to, you know, Nat Geo or Discovery Channel. And when we see scientists trying to understand any given population, living things in this case, one of the things that they do is they tag and track. They say, let me find a couple of individuals in the population, let me tag these individuals, and then let me track these individuals over space and time and try to understand how these individuals behave amongst their own society, their own species, and how they relate to other species and the environment and how they react to certain environmental inputs and stimuli. Nobody's done that for man-made objects in space. We kind of treat everything like it's the same thing, except that we know that it's not all the same thing. And so we want to approach the man-made space object population, which is mostly debris, as if it was an ecosystem comprised of different species of things. And these species live in different habitats. LEO is a habitat. Sun-synchronous orbits is a habitat. Geostationary, geosynchronous, that's a habitat. And so a piece of multi-layer insulation, for instance, let's say that was a species, MLI is a species. Well, MLI in LEO is going to behave differently than MLI in GEO just because of the space environment in which that thing is living, in which it's interacting. And so we'd like to create a taxonomy, scientifically derived taxonomy, much like a taxonomy exists for biological systems, where we can do something like mapping the genome of man-made objects such that we can understand these things in terms of species and understand their behavior in that context and even help ourselves know what sort of data do we need to really understand rocket bodies versus just dead satellites versus multi-layer insulation. Is it the same data? Right now, we kind of use the same sensors to track anything. And we don't necessarily optimize the way we use those sensors based on the specific species of object because we haven't created a taxonomy, a scientifically derived taxonomy for these things. And so it's kind of like we've been shooting ourselves in the foot by not doing that. Now, certainly we can't just go up and tag objects because that's a very expensive endeavor. But we have to do the equivalent of the tagging by having very smart algorithms, very smart math and physics, and iteratively try to understand these things better, knowing that these things behave differently depending on their size, their shape, what, you know, their material composition, and again, trying to create that taxonomy to understand these things better.
So help me with this, because in a way, it's kind of hard to get my arms around all of this, but there has been an underlying assumption, though it's never been talked about, as far as I know, it's never been asked. As I said, I've not ever heard anyone asking these questions on the space show, and, you know, as I said, we have close to 3,000 guests and a lot of programs on space debris with people from all over the world in spacefaring countries. There is an underlying assumption, at least I think so, that when space objects are designed and they're it's planned on how they're going to launch and fly and orbit and deorbit, and whether they're going to bring them down and burn them up or whether they're going to boost them to another orbit or, you know, blow out something that creates drag to make it come down faster, whatever they're going to do, that the designers of this stuff have a pretty good idea how their hardware is going to fly and behave in space. But what I'm hearing from you is that that's not really what this hardware does in space, especially when it's outlived its useful life and it's flying around as debris. So is this something that's not understood by the designers when they make the hardware or not thought about? Or does the characteristic of the object change when it's no longer useful? Or all
thank
of the
above? Thank you so much. Yeah. No, I thank you for these questions because this is exactly what we need to have a candid discussion about. So the answer is this. Being somebody that's done, that's navigated several spacecraft, you know, most of them to Mars, but some to other places, I can tell you that the reality of how the object behaves is different from how it was designed. And the thing is, I think the most fascinating aspect of being a spacecraft navigator is that there's detective work. It's like you try to understand the object as much as possible before you launch it. You take all the measurements. You understand what materials it's made out of and where those materials are placed. You understand where the hardware is and all these things. But then once it's on orbit, it's almost like each spacecraft has its own life. Nothing's perfect, as you can imagine. One of the things that I like telling people is that there's no such thing as a truth sensor. Every sensor lies. Every sensor is a liar. Some lie less than others, but no sensor tells you the truth. And so it's the detective work of saying, this is how I designed it. This is how I intended it to behave. But I'm observing through imperfect observations, I'm observing this, which is different. And how do I reconcile the difference between, you know, what I designed and reality or some measurement of reality that's, you know, again, not exactly accurate or precise. And I can tell you that that's a fascinating activity to undergo. And you'd be amazed at how different these spacecraft actually behave once they're on orbit because of a variety of reasons, whether it's outgassing that didn't quite happen the way you planned, or it's because a thruster isn't quite functioning exactly how you tested it on the ground, or a solar panel isn't necessarily completely straight but is bent slightly in a way that you didn't predict. So there are all these things, all these nuances that that really affect the behavior of objects in a way that you can't necessarily predict, but it's only once the thing's on orbit and you start taking measurements that your detective work starts in trying to quantify and refine your knowledge of all the things interacting with the object that are driving its behavior such that you can do a better job with predicting how that thing's going to behave. Now, that said, extending to the latter part of what you brought up, very few people really take into account how the thing's going to behave once it stops working. And I can tell you that nobody fully understands what that actually means. Like, the science behind fully understanding how all of these objects behave once they stop working and they are at the mercy of the space environment. I mean, these things start tumbling, you know, glue, the adhesives used to glue on solar cell material. There's no glue that lasts forever. So at some point, when do the solar cells start to peel off? At what point, if this thing is just aimlessly tumbling, at what point, due to material fatigue, does the solar panels break off of the object or the multi-layer insulation that's also kind of glued on? At what point does that start to delaminate? Nobody's observed these things because we don't have ubiquitous data. We don't have sensors and live video coverage on every object all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so we can only infer these things or hypothesize these things kind of after the fact just based on the detections that we can collect from space surveillance type sensors. And the data that we have is very sparse on all this stuff. So it's a huge problem. And so part of the understanding of the orbital debris population is really trying to understand all of the sources, all of the things that are adding objects into this population beyond just when things collide or if they blow up in space, which is part of the sources into the population, but just simple material aging and degradation, and when do things break up just on their own, just because nothing lasts forever. Nobody's really done the hard science on that. So that's a great question.
Earlier this month, I did a show with an space archaeologist who's been on the show before, Dr. Alice Gorman, and she's in Australia. And she was defining for us what space archaeology is. And one of the things she said they're really interested in, like on a land dig, for example, they like to see how human artifacts and, you know, pottery or structures or buildings, how they deteriorate over time and what causes a deterioration. And she says they're really interested in how space hardware breaks apart and deteriorates, and there's very little information on it. And we were joking that they ought to start sending hardware up with selfie cameras so that they can take pictures of how they're deteriorating every once in a while and send it back to wherever for space archaeologists, although she said there's probably a lot of proprietary information in that that they don't want customers or others to know. But from the space archaeology point of view, they're interested in how these objects deteriorate and how that deterioration affects them as space debris objects. So that seems pretty similar and compatible to what you're doing, but it's a different field. I don't think archaeology is the same as what you're talking about.
Well, so, I mean, the same things that you said that they're interested in, that's exactly the same stuff that we're interested in. We have a material scientist, you know, at the University of Arizona, you know, Professor Erica Corral, and that, you know, she's the one who we're trying to enlist on our team to really try to get her involved in this idea of material aging. How does the material age? How does it degrade? And then try to bring on some structural dynamicists to say, okay, if this is the way that I built it and I used these bolts and I exposed it to this environment and I just let it, you know, be at the mercy of that environment, at what point do things start breaking off and that sort of thing, and come up with some hypotheses and then try to coordinate when people have satellites that stop working and try to take as many observations and the right observations on those objects to see if we can reconcile how the thing is actually breaking up or how it behaves with these hypotheses.
Is it okay with you if I introduce you to Alice via email?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love that.
Okay, I will do so. I have an email from Jerry Everett, and he is in Merritt Island, Florida. And he says, this is a little bit maybe off topic, I don't know, we'll see how you answer it. What do you think of the potential of the SpaceX ITS, that's their big rocket that they want to build to go to Mars, second stage as a space garbage scow, given its large capacity and maneuverability? So I guess he's thinking of using that as a debris remover. Is that something that you've considered or thought about?
Well, so before we even get into the removal piece, which we're certainly interested in, I want to understand the problem first. I know that the first things that you kind of want to remove from the population are the big objects, the rocket bodies, because when those either explode or collide with anything, those tend to become many, many more objects, smaller ones. And so because those generate lots of objects, there's definitely a priority if you're going to remove anything to remove those things first. I can tell you one of the challenges with the rocket bodies is that these things are tumbling and have a large amount of angular momentum. And so you can't just grab these things. You can't just put a net around them. You can't just harpoon them because these things are tumbling and they have a lot of rotational momentum and angular momentum. And so how do you de-spin these things so that they're more stable and more something that you know, it's easier to handle than something that's just randomly tumbling? And we haven't quite figured that one out yet.
So before starting to look at how to remove or something like that, figuring out how to understand all of what this stuff is and how to deal with it is probably what needs to happen first, and unfortunately that's not happened yet, right?
Exactly.
Interesting. Are new products, new satellites going up? Is there an effort, like on your part or the part of others, to educate designers and mission designers and hardware builders to do a better job of understanding what's going to happen when this stuff has outlived its useful life? Is anything changing on the design front to maybe do a better job of having information on this?
Yeah, so the answer is yes, and this isn't being done by us. There's an entity called IADC. I think it's like Interagency Debris Coordination Committee or something like that, IADC.org, that people can check out. And this is a kind of international entity comprised of governments, civil entities and governments that have space agencies or have space resources. And so there's a bit over a dozen of these countries that have come together, and they meet periodically and they discuss these sorts of things, and they come up with guidelines for debris mitigation. And some of these guidelines do incorporate recommendations for how to design or build and whatnot satellites in a way that could minimize the further generation of orbital debris. So the IADC currently engages in that, and certainly, you know, our efforts are to help those sorts of efforts be even better if possible.
Carl is in Austin, Texas, and he says, does your science or does your work at all contribute to possibly using space debris or other hardware as a space weapon?
So the answer is absolutely not. There's absolutely nothing that we're doing in the space object behavioral sciences work or science or engineering that is intended in any way, shape, or form to be used in harmful or weapon-like fashions. It's all really founded upon trying to understand really the science, just the knowledge of what's up there, how's it behaving, can we predict how it will behave, what's causing the phenomena and that sort of stuff, and trying to use that knowledge to better educate folks around the planet writ large, because more and more people are accessing space and exploiting space, and the knowledge is also being used to help with orbital safety and the long-term preservation of that space environment for future generations. So that's really what's driving our work.
You have an email from Benny, but first, listeners, we're a little more than halfway in the program, so your emails are certainly welcome, but the phone line is available if you want to use it, and there's plenty of time for you to do so, 1-866-687-7223. So Benny sent in a note from Boulder, and he said there are lots and lots of CubeSats and very small sats going up, and there are even soon going to be dedicated small satellite launchers. Does your work intend to look at the behavior, for lack of a better word, of CubeSats, or are they so small with such a short life expectancy that you don't consider them at this time?
Yeah, so we are considering them. In fact, it's definitely a huge concern, especially because, you know, the cost of getting a space is becoming cheaper. More and more people have access to these CubeSats and the ability to put them on orbit. You have many new space companies that are already proposing having hundreds of satellites in their small satellites in their constellations. And so CubeSats are definitely of concern, and small sats as well. One of the main things that I try to tell people is, whatever it is that you want to put on orbit, try to make sure that it's a trackable object, meaning even if the thing fails and doesn't work, that it's something that can be tracked. And there's a difference between something that's detectable and something that's trackable. We actually detect many, 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 many things, but we actually track, most of the things that we detect, in fact, are not things that we can track for a variety of reasons. And so that poses a hazard and a danger and a threat to things that actually work delivering these space services and capabilities. And so, you know, the thing that makes something go from detectable to trackable is being able to, A, detect something as often as you need to and as frequently as needed, but two, being able to know the unique identification of that object as well. So an object needs to be able to be uniquely identified, and it needs to be detected frequently and with high confidence. And if you can do that, then all of a sudden it's something that you can track. It's something that you can kind of maintain knowledge of, and you can predict where it's going to be so that you can find it again at some point in the future, because things are moving around in orbit at very high speeds. So the message that we try to get across to people, even with the CubeSats, and some people have been proposing things like chipsets, very smaller than CubeSats, is don't put up anything in space unless you can show that the object is trackable, even if it fails.
Interesting. They might object to that because that would be cost and mass. But so are you getting blowback on that, or is it being accepted?
Well, I mean, I think the idea or the concept, by most people is accepted as, yeah, that makes sense and we should do that. But it's not like people can regulate that at this point. It's not like there's some sort of, space enforcement agency that is going around to everybody who has launch capabilities to make sure that that happens. So we're a long ways away from being able to kind of enforce those sorts of things. But certainly, from a responsibility for orbital safety and long-term preservation, it makes sense to try to adhere to that.
You need to become the first space cop. I don't know how that will work.
But, well, So the funny thing to tell you about that is that, you know, my first real job, you know, coming out of high school was I was a security policeman in the U.S. Air Force, stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base
in
Montana, guarding ICBMs and chasing ground squirrels. So maybe there's something to that. Maybe I'm making full circle here.
That's right. Well, yeah, at least the ICBMs were supposed to get through space on the way to their target. You have another note from Wayne, and he is in Phoenix, Arizona, and he says, I'm wondering if with all of the CubeSat and SmallSat and commercial business that's happening, what you think of the hardware that private companies claim they can now deliver to the moon vis-a-vis Google Lunar XPRIZE, or some companies talking about even going to Mars with private company efforts and hardware. So does this hardware change in deep space if it were to fail or be stuck in deep space? Are there concerns there along the same concerns that you have in low Earth orbit to geo range? Is that something we should be thinking about now before the industry for deep space really gets going?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that you need to take into account if you want to go to, you know, the moon and you're going to try to do, you know, interplanetary type stuff, is, you know, you're going to be exposed to a variety of different types of space environments, different doses of radiation, charged particles, that sort of stuff. So you need to build your hardware to be robust, sufficiently robust to against failures when your hardware is flying in those sorts of harsh environments. Certainly, the timelines involved in these missions, are definitely lengthier at times, and so, you know, you need to be able to build this stuff to survive not only the harshness of the space environment, of again doses of radiation, charged particles, that sort of stuff, but also longevity and being able to last as long to be able to get there and operate in those environments for long periods of time. So I think, you know, the operating in space is still a risky thing. It's not easy, even though it seems like it's, you know, second nature. It isn't. There's still a risk involved. And I think it's very ambitious for commercial companies to want to go to leave the Earth's geosphere, so to speak, and do these things. I certainly applaud and encourage commerce to go in that direction because I think it makes sense. You know, you have people like Planetary Resources that want to do asteroid mining, and other people that, like you said, want to go to the moon and Mars, Elon Musk and others. But I definitely applaud that. But I do want people to realize that, you know, when you talk about exploration means risk. You're not really exploring unless you're really pushing yourself to the limit. And as long as commercial companies realize that, you know, this isn't just secondhand stuff, but you got to really think about this stuff, and there's risks involved, then I think that's what needs to happen.
Absolutely. Here's another one for you. Terry is in San Diego, and he said, while you were at the University of Arizona, do you teach these classes to undergraduates or graduates? What is the student reaction, and do students want to take courses in space object behavioral sciences?
Great question. So right now, we're actually developing the coursework. We haven't started offering specific coursework to space object behavioral sciences yet. We're developing that right now. And in fact, we intend to start offering a Master's of Engineering in Space Situational Awareness around this time next year. We're also working with various companies within the government and needs to people that are just really specific, just commercial, in trying to put together some training and certificate programs as well. And the way that we're trying to, you know, develop this is kind of like Hogwarts from Harry Potter, in the sense that, you know, you can get your degree in astronomy or in physics or in political science or in law, aerospace engineering, but everybody takes the dark arts classes kind of thing, so that, you know, somebody who wants to be a politician at least has, you know, gone to the top of a mountain and looked through a telescope and recognizes what it takes to track an object. But at the same time, the astronomer has taken a policy course to recognize that, hey, it's not so easy to, you know, try to reach decisions and consensus and what it takes to actually pass laws and policies and regulations. But everybody gets exposed to a little bit of everybody else's kind of pain, so that when they do graduate with their degrees and go out into the workforce, they have an understanding of how the system works from a holistic sense.
Listeners, remember we're on the 60-minute format, so we are nearing the end of the program. So, again, if you do want to call, it is 866-687-7223, and email remains drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. When you first started talking about space object behavior and describing it to us, you included natural as well as man-made, and we've spent nearly an hour talking about man-made, but we really haven't said anything about natural. So talk to us about natural object behavior. You're able to group the man-made, you know, stuff by orbit or by some other classification system. What do you do with the natural items? I know you group them by size, I guess, and maybe what the material is made of, but what helps you understand their behavior?
Yeah, so great question. Most of our emphasis kind of coming out of the gate has been on the man-made objects, but certainly on the natural objects, you know, there are taxonomies that exist for them so far. They've, you know, been heavily studied, a lot more so than the man-made objects for sure. One of the things that we're focused on when it comes to the natural objects is planetary defense. And when I say planetary defense, NASA now has this Office of Planetary Defense that's led by Lindley Johnson in Washington, D.C., where we're talking about detection, tracking, and collision prediction of near-Earth asteroids with the Earth. And so when it comes to the natural space object behavior, we're mostly focused right now on the planetary defense mission and coming up with possibly improved algorithms to better detect near-Earth objects and characterize them and understand their trajectories, their orbits, and be able to predict their trajectories with enough realism in the uncertainty, so that when we say there's a collision warning between this asteroid and the Earth, it's something that's really realistic and something that is very credible.
Do the natural objects have any big impact on man-made objects? Do they have to be really close to one another for there to be some kind of impact or effect?
You know, great question. I'm going to say that I don't quite know the answer. I mean, certainly from a gravitational perspective, you know, there is going to be some interaction gravitationally, you know, between the mass of the asteroid and, you know, the man-made object. So clearly the closer that object is to this asteroid, to this natural object, the more it's going to be influenced, you know, by that object's, you know, gravity field or mass influence. But aside from that, I mean, you have small particles, little meteors and that sort of stuff that could impact man-made objects and could actually, you know, disrupt or completely, you know, destroy a satellite. I don't know. Historically, I mean, people at the Orbital Debris Program Office at NASA, Johnson Space Center, certainly would know a lot more about that than I do in terms of historically, have there been any kind of known natural on man-made object kind of, you know, collisions and stuff like that. But I, off the top of my head, I don't know of any.
You have a note from Marshall in Dallas, near Dallas, Texas. He's in a little town called Saxe, Texas. The Russians, back in the 1970s, put a 23-millimeter cannon, the R-23M Kartek, on the Almaz space station and test-fired it in 1975. if we put a space gun in orbit and used it to shoot space junk, wouldn't it slow down the junk enough to deorbit it? If the junk shatters, wouldn't 99% of it quickly deorbit? Can we shoot and destroy meteors as well?
Well, so one of the things that we definitely want to avoid doing is, sending something to an object to make it break up into something smaller. Because we just, there's no way that you can predict exactly how many pieces would be generated, what directions those things would go. And unless the objects are in sufficient low Earth orbit and the impact of the collision is sufficiently high, then chances are, the pieces that you generate would not reenter. I mean, a case in point is in 2007, the Chinese sent a kinetic vehicle, an anti-satellite weapon, and blew up one of their own satellites in an orbit that was high enough such that most of those pieces will never reenter. They're going to be there. It's now garbage in perpetuity. And, the U.S. Department of Defense, U.S. Strategic Command, they have a catalog of about 22,000 objects the size of a softball and larger. Out of the 22,000 objects, about, 3,500 to 4,000 were created instantaneously by the Chinese doing that. So I think staying away from, taking guns and blowing stuff up, we're going to try to stay away from that.
So, Marshall, not even a close call there. So, no cannons, I guess, to space. Where do you see this field in a couple of years from now, given that it's so new? What would be your, say, five-year goal for this field?
My five-year goal for this field is for everybody to share observations a lot more than what's happening now. We have this thing called Cyverse, stands for Cyber Universe, cyverse.org, which is a $100 million National Science Foundation computational platform developed for plant sciences, now life sciences, that we plan on using to understand things in space like this ecosystem. In 5 years from now, I'm hoping that we can understand more things in orbit because we're doing a better job sharing data and having a common data pool that's extremely large that we can expose to as many people as possible so that you have many smart people all over the globe looking at the same data and coming up with their own conclusions and then comparing these conclusions amongst ourselves in a community such that we can start deriving hypotheses that are testable and are reproducible and that sort of stuff. So that's where I'd like to see us in 5 years.
One last question came in, and this is Tom, and he is in Oklahoma City. And he said, suppose that you're looking for or engaged in international collaboration on this project. So I'm wondering if you have any ITAR considerations with anything related to what you're doing.
Yeah, so a very good question. Usually the ITAR comes into play if there is a specific software that maybe was developed with, U.S. government dollars, or if there are sensor data that belong to the U.S. government. Those are, the data itself usually isn't necessarily ITAR, but talking about the specific sensor or sharing information about specific government sensors, that tends to be ITAR. And so because at the University of Arizona, we have our own telescope systems, we can get we don't necessarily fall into that, but we do understand how to protect ITAR information and also critical but unclassified information, and we have ways to handle that. So it's kind of like we have a multi-tiered process in which some of the items that we deal with and develop are completely available for public distribution and can collaborate very, very easily with colleagues in many other countries. In fact, we have relationships with people in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Germany, Japan, Switzerland, the UK, many different places around the globe that we collaborate right now without getting into the ITAR issues. But certainly, when U.S. government is wanting us to do very specific things germane to its own needs, then that's usually when you see, you know, CUI or ITAR-related issues, and we know how to deal with that.
So the bottom line is that you have people that that are sensitive to ITAR issues, and when applicable, you deal with it. That's probably the way to say it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, you know, I've heard recent kind of things from people just in general that get nervous when they think about universities doing this sort of work. And I tell them, you know, you should obviously be concerned and you should ask these questions. But, I mean, you know, universities have been doing very sensitive work forever. You know, I mean, look at the Apollo program. It wasn't like stuff that happened during Apollo was publicized, you know, all over the globe, all the algorithms and all that stuff. And I got to tell you, you know, if it weren't for MIT, Apollo would have never happened. So anything of significant technological advancement that the U.S. has been involved in has not happened without a strong academic partnership. So academia knows how to do this stuff.
This has been great talking to you, and especially since this discipline and your program is almost brand new. So it'll be fun following you on future visits to the space show and see how the field is changing and growing and how the concerns are being met and being expanded. And I really do look forward to that. So I hope you'll come back on down the road and update us and keep us posted on how things are moving and what you're doing.
Oh, I would love to. Can't wait for the future to become the present so we can talk about this stuff again.
Okay, and listen, we appreciate your being here. How often are you on campus in Tucson?
Yeah, so basically I'm on campus probably half time. I mean, I travel so much, you know, not only just going around the globe, but also interacting with different agencies in the U.S., but yeah, I'd probably say about half-time I'm on campus during fall and spring semester.
Well, you're not missing much of a football season for them this year, so in case you're a football fan, but I still follow them, and they stink. What else can one say? It has really been fun and very informative talking to you, and I do will look forward to staying in touch, and we'll talk down the road and stay up on this field, and introduce you to Alice Gorman early in the morning, and I'll send you the information on the archive show early in the morning, California time as well, and we'll do it again down the road.
All right, beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and have a great night. And listeners, that's it for our show tonight. Thank you for sending in your emails, and back again on Friday and Sunday with more Space Show programming. Everybody have a great rest of the week. Good night from the Space Show.